This is What Does It Profit? And I'm your host, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. Each week in this podcast, I'll talk to some of the leading thinkers and researchers, entrepreneurs and executives about things like conscious capitalism, sustainability, and business ethics. Things that feel all the more urgent as we as a planet face enormous challenges. Climate change, pandemics, and demands for social reform. Many of these challenges brought about, some would argue, by capitalism. Each episode, each guest will bring me a little closer to finding out what does it profit. The traditional story of business is maximizing profit for shareholders, but businesses have an impact on people's lives other than money. It's no longer viable for businesses to choose profit over people.
We started Conscious Capitalism in 2008. And for me, it was the offshoot of a book that I wrote called Firms of Endearment that came out in 2007, which actually was my turning point because I took all of that frustration and angst, what Joseph Campbell would call following my heartbreak, and I channeled it into looking for a better way. I said, there must be a better way to do business.
My guest today, Raj Sisodia, is flipping the script. He's the co-founder of the Conscious Capitalism Movement, a philosophy that reimagines capitalism and provides a blueprint for businesses to embrace socially responsible practices. Under conscious capitalism, businesses are not only profitable, but they have employees who enjoy coming to work, have loyal customers, and make a positive change in the world. Raj, welcome to our conversation about your world and life work. I think we are most excited to have you here because your role as the founder of the Conscious Capitalism Movement. You've done more than anyone would say to push that movement forward. So welcome to the studio.
Thank you, Dawn. Really happy to be with you today.
Well, you know, I want to start our conversation out with something really big. I see you as the guy who's got a mission to change the story of business. You know, here at What Does It Profit podcast, we are all about this idea of business in service to humanity. And I think you're with us.
Oh, absolutely. And I think we have a great misunderstanding in a way, or just an uninspiring story that we've been telling ourselves about business. And that really matters. There's a much, much better story to be told.
Well, I think that's perfect coming from someone who is a marketing scholar. Tell us a little bit about how you come to the work of thinking about the role of business.
Well, I really came into it with some frustration with marketing. You know, I got a PhD in marketing at Columbia somewhat by accident, I would say. I was getting my MBA in India, and then I learned through some friends of mine who were going to the U.S. Information Agency that they could get you could apply for a PhD in business. I said, I didn't know such a thing exists. So I said, let me come with you. And so I ended up going through that process, and I was the only one from that group of eight of us who actually ends up coming here. So somewhat accidentally, I became a marketing professor. And then as I saw the way in which marketing is practiced and the impact it has on customers, on companies, and on society, and I started to really get disillusioned by it. I said, we're really not having a positive impact on people's well-being. You know, we are causing overconsumption and many health problems for many, many people. And most people don't trust marketing. Companies get a lousy return and society is being hurt in many ways. For example, when we use women's bodies to sell products, there is a cost there. There's eating disorders, body dysmorphia, depression in young women, etc., that can be traced to the depictions in the popular culture. So there's a real cost, and the benefits, as I said, were much less. We were spending $1 trillion just in monetary cost in 2004 on marketing, which was the GDP of India that year. And my question was, how is it that 1.1 billion people are living on what we're spending on ads, coupons, and junk mail? And secondly, what are we getting for all that spending? And the answer really, as I said, was not much, and in fact, many negative things. So I was always sort of idealistic, you know, looking for a better way in the world. You know, that's just who I was. And in the world of business, beyond marketing, you know, we talk about it's a dog-eat-dog world and only the paranoid survive, and it's not personal, it's business. And, you know, we can justify anything in the name of doing business. I remember a scene from The Godfather where the Godfather gets somebody killed and later on meets the son of that person and says, please don't take it personal, it was just business. That's kind of our societal understanding of business. And I just think that is so harmful. That's so corrosive. You know, work is where we spend so much of our lives. And for many people, it's just an ordeal to be endured. And for many other people, it's really a place of deep suffering. And it causes them to have shortened lives and unhappy lives because of the way in which we work and what we do. So all that can be changed. That's really my mission in life now.
Well, and I tell you, you do an excellent job in your most recent book, The Healing Organization, talking about how business is such a source of suffering for so many people. And then what I like about it is that you point this out, but then you go on to tell us that there's hope. Tell us a little bit more about where that hope comes from you. Where do you find this place? Is it in a philosophy? Is it in a sense of spirituality that you have? How do you come to this?
Yeah. Well, it starts by really seeing exemplars of people who are actually embodying this. So there's a dominant narrative out there, and there's plenty of examples of that. And yet there's this counter narrative out there, and has been for a long time, really. You know, in India, we have a company called the Tatas, started in 1870 or so, and they were from day one what today I would call a conscious organization, a purposeful organization, a healing organization. You know, it's the consciousness of the founders of a company that then gets kind of hardwired into the consciousness of the company. And unfortunately, the vast majority of businesses have been started by people with a level of consciousness that is really about power and ego and money. When we kind of made that the story, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy when economists came along and started to say, well, successful businesses are profitable, therefore that must be the purpose, or that should be the purpose of business. And we started to act that way, right? The fact is that if you think about the role of business in society, in a free society like we have, you know, market-based societies, the government does not do that much. They're supposed to provide the basic infrastructure and the conditions wherein private enterprise can come in and sense and meet all our needs. The majority of our needs are met by companies. And so we have the great opportunity in a free society to do that. But with that comes a great responsibility, because when you're meeting somebody's needs, if you do that in the right way, you make them whole and you, in a way, heal them. But if you do that with a mindset of using and exploiting them, right, and converting those needs into wants, desires, and addictions, right, and dependencies, where you see them as a means to your own end, right, where we see, you know, using employees and tricking customers and so forth so that I can make as much money for myself. Well, that's one way to be in business, and that's going to cause a lot of suffering, because we're going to squeeze those employees, you know, exploit those customers, we're going to squeeze our suppliers, we will burden our communities, we will damage our ecosystem in order to maximize that profit. But if I see business as a way of serving people, of taking care of them, right? And I see it as a vehicle of expressing my own unique purpose and my own unique gifts in this life. If I come with that energy, then I will heal them. The way, another way I express that is to say, we are all here to take care of each other. And business is an amazing thing that we have invented where we can do that at scale, right? Normally in my life, I can take care of 5-10 people. But if I start a company, I can take care of 100, 1,000, 10,000, hundreds of thousands. There's no limit really to the potential reach of a business. So again, but the energy behind it is what ultimately matters. And I think a big part of where we went wrong really was that the whole world of business and our democracy, really, capitalism and democracy evolved. They were born elsewhere, but they grew in this country, and they evolved with a very hyper-masculine track, each of them. You know, women were not given any role in this society politically, could not vote for 140 years after the founding of this country, could not own property, could not inherit things, you know, had no real say. And therefore, our political and societal culture became hyper-masculine. Domination, aggression, winning results at all costs. We left out more than half of humanity. And the same thing in capitalism. You know, we left out the human need to care, which is the softer side. Right, Adam Smith, who wrote The Wealth of Nations, which is about free markets and freedom leading to prosperity and the power of that. But also he wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments, The Human Need to Care. And we left that out. And that's kind of the mother energy.
And I think people forget that he wrote that one first.
Yeah, 17 years, I believe, before, right? And that's considered more, he considered that his masterwork. But we left that out. The way I say it somewhat jokingly is that capitalism had a mother and a father, and they were both Adam Smith. But as we do in life, very often, you know, we take that mother energy for granted. And we're always after that, you know, the worldly success that our fathers often represent. So, you know, we again devolved into this mode in capitalism, which is all about power and ego. You know, we had empires that were built in the old days, political empires, by conquering and killing and all of that. And then we transformed that energy, or transmuted that into business empires. You know, the Rockefellers and Carnegies of the world and so forth, J.P. Morgan and others, right? It was ruthless. There was no limit to it. It was not about fulfilling some, you know, some real need. It was really about an ego that could never be filled or satisfied, right? And we came to see that as a devil's bargain, that we can accept that and, you know, accept the idea that selfishness and greed are driving that. And ultimately that leads to progress in the world, and that's okay. And now we're saying, no, that is not okay. Selfishness and greed are never virtues, and that we can achieve all of the positive gains of technological innovation, of uplifting of people from poverty, of extending human lifespans and all of that. We can achieve all of those without having the negative consequences of that approach to business, which are many. As we document in the book, you know, heart attacks are 20% higher on Mondays. 120,000 Americans die just from stress connected to work. 600,000 Chinese die from overwork. Another million Chinese die every year from pollution. All of these can be traced back to how we do business, right? And this is just the tip of the iceberg. What's happening with people's level of stress, how many lives are getting shortened, what's happening to their children, what's happening to their families, their communities. And of course, we are the only species in the history of this planet, largely through the instrument of business, which is destroying its own ecosystem. We are destroying the very thing that enables us to survive and live. And we're rapidly depleting, you know, that natural ecosystem at a rate that, you know, within a few decades, you know, we are looking at an irreversible decline there. So all of that has to change. And unless business is the lead actor in that turnaround, we don't have a chance. So that's really what our movement and what my life really has become about.
Well, tell us more about this idea of being a movement. I mean, clearly you have a strong vision, a healthy vision, an inspirational vision for business, but nothing is going to change unless others come along with you. And you've had some success doing that. Tell me more about how this movement of conscious capitalism has evolved.
Yeah, so we started Conscious Capitalism in 2008. And for me, it was the offshoot of a book that I wrote called Firms of Endearment that came out in 2007, which actually was my turning point because I took all of that frustration and angst, what Joseph Campbell would call following my heartbreak, and I channeled it into looking for a better way. I said, there must be a better way to do business. And I found a bunch of companies, and ultimately 28, which we call firms of endearment, right? Companies that are loved, not only by customers, but by employees, by communities, by suppliers. They're good for the world, etc. And we found a pattern in their way of being, that they had a higher purpose. There's a reason why these companies exist, not just to make money. Money, you have to make money, right, in order to survive as a business, but that's not your reason for being. It's like saying, I need to breathe or I need to have red blood cells to live, but I don't dedicate my life to producing as many red blood cells as I can or breathing as much as I can, right? I use that to achieve something with my life. So every business should have its values and a core purpose and then take care of all of your stakeholders. Right, customers, employees, etc. So we discovered a pattern, stakeholder orientation, a clear set of higher purpose and core values, and then leaders who are primarily motivated by service to people and that purpose and not about power and ego and money, and cultures that are rooted in trust and caring. So I found that pattern, and we found that also these companies were dramatically more successful in financial terms. That's when we had our first conference. So that was the beginning. Now, we fast forward 12 years later, and actually 2019, was kind of a tipping point year because the Business Roundtable, which is the association of 183 of the largest U.S. corporations, had long had a statement of the purpose of business that was all about economic value creation, the old shareholder value, profit maximization mantra that drives American capitalism. And they made a fundamental shift. And they said business needs to have, every company needs to have its own purpose, and they need to create value for all of their stakeholders. They need to think long-term and holistic. Right? And they need to treat people with respect and dignity. And so they were essentially, and they acknowledged it as much, they were sort of adopting our language and what we had been talking about for all these years. And by the way, it's not just us. There are other parallel movements. There's Just Capital. There's Inclusive Capitalism. And there's the B Team and B Corp and so forth. A lot of people have been seeing the problem. So I felt like we were reaching, and Davos as well, the World Economic Forum, in December issued their Davos Declaration, which was a call for stakeholder capitalism, not shareholder capitalism. So I feel like after all these years that we are arriving kind of at our own Berlin Wall moment. Remember the Berlin Wall, nobody could have predicted the night before, that a few days before that this would happen, right? And the world was fundamentally transformed when that event occurred because we had the defining debate of the 20th century between those competing visions of society, and suddenly that debate was over. And we feel like we're getting to that point soon, if not there already, where that debate is going to be over, that somebody who argues that business can only be about making money and nothing else should really matter, you know, they're going to have to answer for all of the negative consequences that that mindset brings upon us, from devastated ecosystems to destroyed psyches, to depression, to anxiety, to all kinds of things that are happening in our world because of that mindset.
Mm. Well, I think it takes an extraordinary business leader to be able to have the courage to, be honest.
You know, I think we're starting to see it in this, you know, the so-called essential workers, right, that we have all come to now lately celebrate. they're always essential and they always do hard work for very little money. And we just need to change our system, you know. One of the companies we write about in the book is HEB, which is the largest grocery chain in Texas. It's a privately owned company. It was started by the grandmother of the current chairman, Charles Butt. Florence Butt started it. It was always had a, the root of it was caring and community, right? I mean, when she started this little grocery store, she and her son would, in a little wheelbarrow, take food down to the river where the homeless people were and just help them, serve them. So that, you know, that energy, that DNA is still in that company. It's a $25 billion a year company. Now, it's the most beloved company in Texas. It's the largest donor to the state of Texas. It is also the best place to work in its industry. People are far better paid and much better benefits, and yet it has prices that are lower than Walmart. They show up in times of emergency like the Hurricane Harvey, etc., before the Red Cross and before FEMA. They have 24/7, 365 days a year emergency operations. They've got helicopters, etc. They open the stores as quickly as possible. I mean, they're just there, you know, as part of the community. And one of the things that Charles Butt, the current chairman, tells the CEO and other executives is, please pay our people as much as possible, not as little as possible. See, you design a whole business model and business philosophy around the idea. Costco, Jim Sinegal does that. You know, he was paying double of Walmart, and Wall Street analysts saying, you're a public company, you're stealing from the shareholders to pay your employees. And he said, well, I think people should be able to look after their families and lead a decent life. So that's not changing. And he said, by the way, our employee turnover is 7% and Walmart's is 70%. Okay, so people come and never leave, so we get all the benefit of productivity and innovation. And by the way, our sales per employee are 3 times higher than Walmart. So even though we pay double, our labor productivity is actually better. You know, there are all these benefits that flow when you treat people well with respect and dignity, right, and enable them to lead lives where they are not thriving, but they're actually, you know, at least they're not struggling, you know, the way most are today.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a path upwards.
Well, one of my favorite stories from the healing organization starts with a Zen poem. Indulge me. Drink tea and savor life, and with the first sip, joy, and the second sip, peace, and the third, a brownie. That's the story you give us about Grayston Bakery. You know, those guys in Yonkers who are baking brownies to hire people.
Ben was at a conference with other leaders in social enterprise, and Ben met Bernie Glassman, who is the founder of the Grayston community. Bernie's goal was to provide employment for those with barriers to employment, and started this bakery. And it was part of a larger community that was also providing services in Yonkers, New York, where Grayston is.
The Grayston Foundation is a multiplicity of different organizations. The foundation is at the top. It's a not-for-profit 501c3. And the largest part of the Grayston Foundation is its for-profit affiliate, the Grayston Bakery.
And so Ben said to Bernie, hey, look, you bake things. Why don't we figure out what you can bake for us, which turned out to be brownies. We make ice cream. We'll put them in the ice cream and, you know, let's make it really good and let's see what happens.
For 30 years, Grayston has been a leading social enterprise, combining contract manufacturing, baking with a social justice program based around open hiring, which means anyone that walks in the front door of our bakery, we offer a job. They put their name on a list and we give them a position. Around the open hiring program, we have other capabilities through Grayston Foundation.
We provide about 300 units of affordable housing in Yonkers and the surrounding area. We have a childcare center. We have a community gardens program. We have a program to service people with HIV and AIDS. And we have a workforce development program to help train people for jobs other than in our bakery.
Part of the relationship that's really important is that what we're trying to do is to see how business can create social good.
The idea that business can be used, business can be seen as a means to an end, right? It's not just for make money to put into my pocket. It's a way to give meaning and purpose and dignity and a first chance. You know, Bernie Glassman, who's a Zen master, he said there are people in our country, millions, tens of millions, who'd never even get a first chance. Forget about a second chance, right? So if you're born into a ghetto and you're surrounded by drugs and violence and you have terrible schools, right? And very few prospects in life going forward. And very soon you get caught up in that system. And the system is geared and designed to imprison as many people as possible. And then 3 strikes and you're out. You know, all the things that we did in criminal justice in the last few decades. There are 70 million people in our country with some kind of criminal record. mostly for nonviolent possession of small amounts of drugs. That's the same number that have a college degree. Okay, think about that. We as a society imprison more people in absolute numbers as well as a percentage than any other society on this planet, by far. This is one aspect of American exceptionalism that we should not be proud of. On the application form, there's a little box, right? And you have to check it. It says, have you ever been convicted of, et cetera. And people, 70 million people, if they're being truthful, have to check that box. And the majority of companies, as they screen, that's one of the first screens that they use. Okay, we're not hiring anybody. They're proud of it. We don't hire anybody with the background, right? But as a result, what happens then? Those people, they try. They've paid their dues more than paid their dues. You know, they're heartbreaking stories of people who did something when they were 16 years old, small amount of drug, and they're 20 years, they're thrown away, locked away. And they come out and now nobody wants to give them a job. And they have no real skills because the prison is not a place of, uplifting or training people. It's just a sort of dehumanizing in itself. And now they try to get an honest job and they can't. And they eventually they can't starve. So they go back on the street to do what they do and they get caught up again. So recidivism is very high and people become more and more hardened over time. So that's the story of this company. They said, we hire people or we bake brownies in order to hire people. And they practiced and they invented this idea of open hiring. You know, they said, there's no interviews and no background checks. So you don't have to lie to us about your criminal record. We're not even going to ask. If you need a job, here's a list, put your name on this list. And all we're going to do is systematically go down that list. And we're going to hire the next person on that list. And we're going to train them for 9 months, give them all kinds of skills, and then place them into the company. And yeah, it's not a lifetime guarantee that you will keep that job. You have to perform once you're given that opportunity. But even if you don't, at least now you've got, you're on your way. Right? Maybe baking is not your real passion ultimately. Maybe something else, but that's fine. So they do that, right? And they've transformed so many lives. It's really, the thing about these companies, it's a relatively small company still, is that they become an inspiration for a company that's 100 times larger than them. You know, so Unilever, for example, one of the world's biggest companies, right, is now looking very closely at this model. And they have some joint thing going with Ben & Jerry's, which is part of Unilever. So they have the opportunity to become catalysts and inspirational role models, and the big lesson, I think Bernie Glassman, who died while we were writing this book, as did Herb Kelleher of Southwest Airlines, who's another one of our heroes as a healing leader. Bernie Glassman was all about bearing witness. And again, it's a very Buddhist wisdom, right? You bear witness to the suffering of others. And from that bearing of witness, loving action will naturally arise, right? So he would, even before he started Grayston, he would take groups of people and they would, in the richest, one of the richest counties in America, which is where Yonkers is, with also one of the highest levels of homelessness. And they would literally go and live on the streets the way the homeless people did for a week. They would experience that life. And then coming out of that, they would then have ideas about what to do about it, right? Loving action would naturally arise. So I think that's what we have to open our eyes and our hearts. If you could see a thought bubble over the head of everybody that you encounter today, and certainly in your workplace, it would break your heart to see the burdens people are carrying around, as many of us are. And when you do that, then you can connect to them. Vulnerability is essential to that empathy and connection. Then we can connect to them and as I said, we are all here to take care of each other and help each other heal. And we have within us what I've got within me, something that will help you heal, and you've got something that's going to help me heal. I think that's the way we should think about all business.
Well, our listeners are likely to be inspired by this message and want to somehow engage and participate. How do folks find out about the companies that are the good guys, the ones that are doing this healing and this good work, and how can they support it as consumers or as potential employees? Where do we find these companies? Well, I know first, read your book.
Yeah, so we write about them. So if you go to consciouscapitalism.org, that's the whole movement. We have chapters in 40 cities in the U.S. and 18 other countries. And each one of those chapters has a number of corporate members as well. So mostly those are conscious companies or they're aspiring conscious companies. Nobody is perfect as a human being or as a company. We're all on a journey towards either towards higher consciousness or away from it. So we want to bring together the ones that are evolving towards higher consciousness. If you go to firmsofendearment.com, which is the website for my earlier book, that has the list of 72 companies that were in the second edition of that book. If you go to healingorganizations.com, that's the website for this book. And I think we have 25 or 28 stories in this book, which are different from the other books, the different companies. So these companies are out there. There's also, you know, the best places to work, the most ethical corporations, there's Just Capitals. You know, there are various rankings and listings that sort of get at this, towards this. You know, if a company is considered a great place to work, it's probably doing some other things right as well. If it's considered highly ethical, ethical place to work, then it's probably doing a lot of things right. So the companies are out there. They are still the minority, but I think it's changing. And especially with the young people, the younger generations, millennials and beyond, they're much more purpose-driven at a younger age than previous generations. And if they do go into business, most of them are also hostile and suspicious towards business. Many of them are of the mind that socialism is better than capitalism, but we know that doesn't work. But the ones who do find their way into business tend to then bring their values and their sense of purpose into those businesses as well.
What does it profit? How does it benefit us? Have you gotten to a place where you're able to articulate what that means for you?
Well, I mean, what I've realized for the last 15 years is, you know, I had a job and I had a career until that point, but I was never happy. I was never fulfilled. I never went to bed thinking, oh my God, I made a real positive difference. You know, I may have made some more money or whatever. But I've gotten onto a path which is really about a calling. This is about what I was born to do. This is about making the world better in my little way. And one realization that came to me with, you know, that same time when I had all those experiences, I also worked with a coach for the first time 2 years ago when I was starting to write this book. And when I told her the story of my life and the trajectory of my work and how it changed in 2005 when I discovered that different path, but really going all the way back to when I was a child growing up in India, not only within a caste system, but born into the most warrior-like caste, the warrior caste, which is one of the five castes in India. And I was born into that, which is a very, very hyper-patriarchal, feudal, misogynistic almost type of a subculture within India. So I grew up with the excesses of the hyper-masculine energy, the abuses and the suffering and everything else that came along with that. And yet I was very much born in my mother's image. I mean, I was much more like her as my being, my essence. And so I've come to think of it that really what the world has been missing is that mother energy. You know, the whole world has been run by men on a limited set of masculine values, and it's all about domination, aggression, winning, and, you know, battles and wars, and everything is all of that, and so much suffering and killing and hurting each other. What we need to do is to bring that other energy. So I've started to think of my life's purpose in those terms, right? That this is what I'm trying to balance in the world and bring to the world. And I think that's really the answer to healing on a mass global scale. We need to simply tap into that other side of the human psyche, which we have suppressed and ignored for millennia, the caring, nurturing side.
Well, Raj, thanks for bringing those energies to us here at What Does It Profit podcast, particularly because of their significance in our world of work and business and investment and a whole new ideological way of seeing the world. You're inspiring, and we appreciate you joining us.
Thank you very much, Dawn. I really enjoyed our conversation, and thank you for bringing this to the world.
This is What Does It Profit? Links to resources related to the issues we've discussed in this episode are in the show notes. Transcripts, reading lists, and lists of our friends can be found at whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. In our next episode, the hedge fund short seller shaking up Wall Street, Fahmi Quadir.
They call me the assassin because of that cloak and daggers approach to shorting. And even with something like Wirecard, the only reason we ultimately did go public with that short position was because of the short selling ban that was put in place. So we really like to do things behind the scenes.
In the meantime, please rate and review us on wherever you're listening and let your friends know about the show. Quick sharing links can be found on our website. Ratings, reviews, and subscriptions on your favorite podcast platform mean so much to us. We would love to hear from you. Show ideas and comments are always welcome. Follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at WDIP Podcast. What Does It Profit? Is written and hosted by me, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. The show is produced by Jordan Gaspour. Executive producers are Nate Toby and Barbara Landis. And special thanks to our talented interns, Nate, Niels, Hannah, and Andrew, and our friends at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business, the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, Business for Impact, the Beck Center for Social Impact and Innovation, the DC Chapter of Conscious Capitalism, and Switchin' Board Studios. Before I let you go, let me remind you to never stop asking yourself, what does it profit?